From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn how avian flu is affecting dairy cows and how it could impact the dairy industry here in Wisconsin. Then we'll meet a social media influencer and blogger who's helping to demystify car care and maintenance.
I'm not teaching you how to take apart your car or any kind of fancy information. I'm bringing the basics that everybody should know, that they should have been taught, that they were often not taught.
Plus, our astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins us to talk about the Northern Lights and how we can see them for ourselves.
To figure out Northern Lights, you need three components. The sun, you need a magnetic field, and you need an atmosphere.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Agriculture officials have detected avian influenza in dairy herds across the country. The U.S. Department of Agriculture first confirmed avian flu in dairy herds in Kansas and Texas late last month. Since then, cases in Michigan, Ohio, Idaho, and New Mexico have also been confirmed. No cases have been detected in dairy cows or humans in Wisconsin, but state leaders are urging dairy farmers to take extra precautions against the spread of avian flu. To learn more about how the virus could impact Wisconsin's dairy industry, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with veterinarian Dr. Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory.
What do we know about this current strain of avian flu, and why is it affecting dairy cows?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We've been working on this problem. We're seeing a lot of sick cows in that southwest part of the United States. And that was really starting in end of January, early February. And what we're seeing now, after working with our partners in Iowa and Cornell and Texas A&M, is that we're seeing the current circulating strain that's causing highly pathogenic avian influenza in our poultry flocks. And it's been causing disease since 2022. And it is now the worst foreign animal disease that we've seen in the United States. But I think there's really three very important points to that. Is one, pasteurized dairy products are safe, and so is meat if cooked properly. Two, these cows are not dying, very different than what we've seen in our poultry flocks, where we've seen high mortality. And then number three is that we don't really consider this an extremely high threat to public health at this time. So those are really our big three. Really, highly pathogenic avian influenza in cows is really not a great name for it, because highly pathogenic avian influenza in birds causes really high mortality, where we're talking almost 100% mortality in a flock in several days. We do not see any mortality with our dairy cows. It's really acting as more of a low path strain, same in people, where we just saw that one confirmed case of conjunctivitis in that dairy farm worker in Texas.
Right. Well, that's a good clarification. And there are a couple of things you mentioned I want to touch on. But I want to clarify, how is the spread among dairy cows happening? Is it solely from bird to cow, or is it spreading among herds?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because when we first came out with this now, maybe a week ago, USDA was very confident that based on the viral sequences with no mammalian markers, we really thought that this was primarily a bird to cow and not amplification from there. But I do think now that we've seen with movement of cows going across state lines from Texas into other states, Ohio, Michigan, and Idaho, is that we are seeing evidence now of lateral transmission. Now, what exactly is causing cow-to-cow transmission? That's a kind of up for debate at this point. I don't think we have enough information. We've seen positive samples in nasal swabs, although cows don't show any type of nasal or respiratory disease, so they don't typically see that upper respiratory like we see with people. We do see it in milk, raw milk, and we do see a little bit in fecal samples in that, but it's not very much. What's really interesting is that the only cows that we really see with clinical disease is that they have a poor appetite and they have less activity. And then because they're decreasing their feed intake, they drop in milk. So they drop in milk production. And some of those cows have fevers, and they're usually 103 to 105, 106 Fahrenheit. So, you know, just like in people, they don't feel great and they don't make a lot of milk. They do recover usually within 10 to 12 days, and their lactations will recover over time, depending on how late they are in their lactation. And then the other thing, thinking about, you know, what cows are these? They tend to be older cows. They're second lactation or greater, which is really, really odd. You know, typically when you think of disease on dairy cows, you think of baby calves that tend to have problems with respiratory mm-hmm. disease. And then this really just seems to be more of a GI function that then has later clinical manifestations and decreased milk. And some cows are seeing real thick milk that almost looks like colostrum, and all of that milk is discarded.
So what I'm understanding that you're saying is that this current strain of avian influenza isn't affecting cow herds the same as poultry flocks. So for instance, if a cow were to be infected with this virus, you wouldn't have to depopulate the cow herd the infected cow came from, similarly as you would for a poultry flock.
Yeah, we've had that question quite a bit of, well, we depopulate the birds with high path. And you're absolutely right, because really there's a humane raising of birds. And because we need to humanely euthanize them before they die, dying from influenza is not a comfortable thing. And we do see super high mortality, up to 100%. We don't see that in our cattle. So it's acting more like a low path strain, or like a low path in cows, which can be challenging to kind of think about. But we do see low path influenza strains in our poultry that they do survive, and they still go to market, and they develop an immune response, just like what people do when you're exposed to flu. And we're not seeing that mortality. So it's kind of a misnomer almost. And I think we're working on that messaging of, this really isn't high path influenza in cows, because the cows are not dying. It's more of the same strain, but it's causing a low pathogenicity or much less severe clinical signs in our dairy cows of a very specific signalment. They're in a very particular part of their lactation, and they're older, which is it's a novel way of seeing clinical disease due to influenza in cows. And this one, we're pretty sure it came from the birds, and the cows seem to be spreading it now.
Right. And we're mentioning all of this and how we've seen this spread of this virus hit Texas and Kansas. I think you mentioned Michigan too. So should the spread of avian flu be of concern to Wisconsin dairy farmers right now?
So I think there's a couple reasons why the dairy industry in the state and the dairy industry in the country are concerned about it. Mainly is public trust for the food. And I think that's why our number one messaging point is pasteurized dairy products are safe. So that's really important. And especially in a state like Wisconsin, public trust and perception of a wholesome and safe product is important. And we want to make sure that the dairy consuming public knows that it's a safe product. The CDC, USDA, and FDA all agree that pasteurization is a very effective way to make sure that we have a wholesome product. Now, the other component, other than, you know, marketing of those products, whether they're domestic or globally, is that right now is a really challenging time to be raising calves in Wisconsin. It was 70 in February, and now we have 6 inches of snow on the ground, and my kids are home from school, right? So it is very, very common in the northern and the Midwestern states to actually send their calves to Kansas and Texas in warmer climates, because it's much more efficient, it's more cost effective, and the health of their calves are better. And then they come back when they're springing heifers. That's the most common way that we see cows coming back into the state of Wisconsin. And of those animals, that's where I think a lot of our dairy producers are concerned about, well, am I bringing influenza back into my herds? And we have good biosecurity recommendations. We've sent that out through the Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. Farm Bureau has that information, and so does the Professional Dairy Producers of Wisconsin. I think the take-home message there is contact your veterinarian. They have really good biosecurity guidance that's all based on securemilksupply.org. And we've really kind of honed that in to look at avian influenza, the strain that we're seeing circulating in cattle right now. We don't have any cases in Wisconsin right now. All the cases that we've seen in Ohio, Michigan, and Idaho have been from transporting lactating cows into those herds, which is really not as common as what we see in Wisconsin of transporting pregnant animals. And we really don't see disease in those animals. So we're really hoping that our risk there is much lower. And then we're developing other biosecurity guidelines with that might include diagnostic testing, which we have available, active observational surveillance from when animals are arriving on the farm to really watch them closely, working with that guidance with our partners, veterinarians at the Department of Animal Trade and Consumer Protection and the USDA.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning how agriculture officials are working to prevent this spread of virus among dairy farms in Wisconsin. And it's migration season, and a lot of wild birds will be flying through Wisconsin. How can this play a factor in the spread of avian flu? And has there been a notable impact on poultry farms in Wisconsin?
Well, since 2022, there has been, but it's been really unpredictable. The spring of 2022, we saw a lot of domestic flocks be affected. But then back in the fall, we were expecting, as those birds were causing problems in South America, that we thought that the migrating birds were going to cause a problem in the fall, and we didn't see it. And then in the spring of 2023, we didn't see anything, and although other states did. But then in the fall, because it was so warm and the drought that we saw last summer really delayed harvest, the birds did not move south very quickly because it was nice and warm. They had lots of food. There was really nothing driving them south. And it's almost been the opposite this spring because we haven't seen any domestic flocks in Wisconsin. We've seen domestic flocks in other states, but we haven't seen it in Wisconsin. And part of what we think about this is that those birds are migrating through much quicker because the ice is out on most of our lakes in the northern part of our state up into Canada. So the birds are moving through quickly. Migration is far from over, but a big chunk of those birds have already moved on, and there's no reason for them to stop because the ice is out and it's starting to warm up, and they'll have plenty of food as they continue to migrate north. So it's hard to predict, but we're hoping that some of their environmental conditions are going to decrease our risk by speeding up our migration.
Right. I want to shift gears a bit and talk about how Texas health officials reported a person testing positive for avian flu last week. This person was in direct contact with infected dairy cows. How much of a risk does the virus pose to humans, and how can the spread of it among people be prevented?
It's a great question, and I think that the stories that have been coming out really on that one confirmed case, we don't want to make a knee-jerk reaction on one case, but it is something that we want to watch very closely. At this time, CDC and USDA and FDA really don't see this as a major risk to the general public, but we do have recommendations for personal protective equipment for farms and farms that would be experiencing or having infected cows. So that one case that was reported was a conjunctivitis, or more like a pink eye. And it's strange that people have a lot of flu receptors actually in that tissue around their eye. That's the pink part around your eye. So what we can do on those farms is to make sure we have personal protective equipment available, safety glasses with shields, or just having the face shield in front, wearing gloves and dedicated clothing. And all of that information is provided in biosecurity guidelines.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you clarifying all of this information and how this really affects Wisconsin and obviously Wisconsin's large agriculture sector in dairy. So thank you again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Dr. Keith Polson is a veterinarian and director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. He spoke with LegaFX expert Nunez. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com, and what you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn about some of the hidden gems in the Milwaukee County Park system of trails.
So you can go to Caesars Park, you can go to Riverside Park, you can go to Estabrook Park, you can go to Lincoln Park, Kern, Gordon, and all find a nice access to the trail.
But first, now that the solar eclipse has passed, we'll speak with astronomy contributor Gene Creighton about another striking visual in the sky, the Northern Lights. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Yesterday, the world was captivated by the solar eclipse. If the eclipse has motivated you to see more astronomical events, how about shifting to the nighttime to see the Northern Lights? The Northern Lights, also known as the Aurora Borealis, are an amazing natural light show visible at certain times of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. But just because they're called the Northern Lights doesn't mean you can't see them here in Wisconsin. Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins me now to share more. Gene, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Great to be with you, Audrey.
So the programming for the Manfred Olson Planetarium for April has a lot to do with the Northern Lights. And despite the name, we can see it in Wisconsin. We'll get into that a little bit more. But let's start with the basics. What are the Northern Lights?
Okay. So the inclusive term is aurora because there's aurora borealis and aurora australis. Most people think about Northern Lights, so I'm going to stick with Northern Lights. I just wanted to introduce the term. To figure out Northern Lights, you need three components. The sun, you need a magnetic field, and you need an atmosphere. So the sun is lots of things, but for our purposes, for this conversation, it is a huge ball of charged moving particles that make a very complex magnetic field. So magnetic fields are invisible to the naked eye, but if you imagine them as connected loops, it's possible to pull the loop so bad that it snaps, and now you have a blob of particles that is sniffing out into space another magnetic field. Check number one. We're all now looking, we're charged particles, and we're looking for a magnetic field, and ooh, we see the Earth. The Earth's magnetic field has lines that loop to the poles, the magnetic poles of the Earth, which happen to be fairly close to the geographic poles of the Earth. So all of these particles now are drawn to the magnetic poles, which is why this is considered a high latitude event mostly. Check, that was number two. So we've driven these beautiful particles, thanks to the magnetic field, in the atmosphere of the Earth. And our atmosphere, as you know, is made principally of nitrogen and oxygen. So now our listeners are going to need to imagine a fist as an electron of oxygen. Bear with me here. So let's remind ourselves here, oxygen has protons, which are positively charged, and neutrons, we don't care about that, and their electrons going around. Okay, so now please imagine that you have a little fist, which is your electron, and you have particles that follow the magnetic field lines from the sun, and they give just enough energy to that electron to bounce up to its next allowable level. So far, are you with me?
With ya.
Excellent.
Coming down on our way to bouncing up.
We're bouncing up. We bounced, and we think, yay, we're all excited. But even electrons don't like to be excited for too long. And they say, okay, just get me back to my comfort zone. So it ejects the excess energy that it has in the form of light. And it boing, 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 goes down to its basic level. That light that we see is aurora.
So we talked about kind of the pathway that was happening, coming down, drawn to the poles, either the north or the south, but aurora in general for Northern Lights, bouncing back up and that light reaction. So you and I have talked in the past about how light is, you know, refracted through the atmosphere and like why sunsets turn into different colors and things like that. So I'm wondering, is the same kind of thing happening with the Northern Lights? There's typically green hues, sometimes an occasional red or blue, but mostly green is what I'm thinking of for Northern Lights. So do these colors mean anything in particular?
Oh, they sure do. They tell us something pretty fundamental about the structure of different elements. So oxygen, for example, we talked a little bit about how that electron boing, 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 goes to a higher level and those then comes down to a lower level. It turns out you can imagine that the energy levels that electrons are allowed in oxygen is like a ladder with rungs at different distances from each other. And nitrogen and actually other element in the periodic table has a unique ladder. The structure of rungs is unique to that. So the energy that any of these things will provide in a situation where they get bombarded from particles from the sun is going to be different. You can think of it as a barcode. The barcode for oxygen is different than the barcode for nitrogen. The barcode of oxygen basically has two colors that we can see without specialized equipment. You get the yellowish green and the red. That's it. For nitrogen, you get a broader palette of colors. You get blues and purples and violets. It's actually, I mean, the combination of the two makes for the beautiful color scheme that you see.
Gotcha. I like that, the barcode analogy. That's super helpful. Barcode in the sky, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we mentioned the poles and how obviously the magnetic fields help us see the northern lights super visible in these areas. Let's start there. If people want to chase northern lights to have the best view in general, where is the best place to see it? And then we can talk about Wisconsin after that.
So you want to go to places that are at high latitudes. So a classic place would be Iceland, off the shores of Norway, the Faroe Islands, Alaska, northern Canada. I know that my in-laws, for example, who live in Calgary, that's where I saw Northern Lights for the first time. It wasn't quite as spectacular as Northern Lights can be, but it was still there. I mean, we just showed up from the airport and there they were. And I said, whoa, is that Northern Lights? And they said, yeah.
Like, normal, day-to-day.
Big deal. So the farther north you are, the more likely you'll just see them, right?
Say, hey, I have the capacity to do a road trip or go somewhere else. Where can we see it in Wisconsin? And is it possible? Does it happen often?
Okay, so you need to know two things. Frankly, even if you go to Iceland, there's no guarantee that you're going to see northern lights, right? It depends on the weather and other things. So in your own backyard, we in Wisconsin have a better chance of seeing northern lights considering our latitude. We're not particularly high, but from a magnetic latitude point of view, we are higher. So we do better than you'd think. You need to know two things. You need to know how active the sun is at this point and your own what's called geomagnetic latitude, which effectively means how active does the sun need to be for you to be able to see northern lights, right? So to figure out how active the sun is, you can go to the NOAA website. So that's the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration that measures what's called the KP index every 3 hours. If the K index is more than 5, it means the sun is active. And if it's less than that, not so much. We are coming up to the high activity of the sun. So you could expect in the next year to have more of these episodes than, say, on quiet, when the sun is quieter in its cycle. But now we're sort of gearing up. So for us, we need the K index to be 6.5 to see northern lights. And when I'm talking about Milwaukee. Now, if you're willing to drive north, not only do you get away from city lights, which could blot them out anyway, but you also get less. The K index needs to be lower for them to be visible higher in Wisconsin. So if I was at total leisure and saw that the K index was, let's say, at 7, I would get in my car and I would go further north to see northern lights. And I know that there have been times when, you know, people have been, it's been all over the internet where people take pictures in northern Wisconsin that are really quite spectacular, actually.
So for people who can't travel either locally or abroad for northern lights exposure, so to speak, What can the planetarium help with?
Well, they can come and see cool footage that I selected with my wonderful production students. They can learn more details about how this works and tools, again, sort of see how we use the NOAA website to figure out when would be a good time to see Northern Lights anywhere you might be.
Well, and after the eclipse is done, we can concentrate back on the dark night skies, right?
Yes. Although, you know, somebody pointed out, one of my staff said, this is my favorite program. And I realized I hadn't said it out loud, but the Northern Light program, I think, has a very special sort of spot in my heart, because not only did I see them, you know, when I first met my in-laws, but I also saw them from the stratosphere. So when I was flying on Sophia, this was not expected, not advertised. It was just bonus, just a cherry on the cake. And I was astonished with what they looked like from the stratosphere. So the Northern Lights really are very special to me.
Well, thank you for sharing more about them today, Jean. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is our astronomy contributor and the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. The planetarium will be giving presentations on the science behind the Northern Lights on April 13th and 20th, and you can find more information at wuwm.com. Car trouble and car questions can cause a lot of stress for drivers. For some, learning how to maintain a car is a bit of a mystery, and when it comes to needing repairs, things can get expensive and confusing. Kaya Milstein is a Milwaukee-based automotive educator, social media influencer, and writer who is working to make cars less complicated, especially for women and queer people. She creates educational content on social media and on her blog, Mechanic Shop Femme, to provide car owners easy-to-understand information. Milstein joins WUWM's Eric Von Fellow, Nadia Kelly, to talk about car myths, sexism in the automotive industry, and her new book.
On the internet, you go by Mechanic Shop Femme, and I was just wondering, what is Mechanic Shop Femme? What type of topics do you talk about underneath that name?
So Mechanic Shop Femme was my handle on Instagram when I started my blog. I thought a lot about it, and I was like, oh, what should I call it? I want to make sure that I bring my whole self to this work, because working in shops, it's not exactly the most welcoming or enjoyable environment to work in, especially as a fat queer woman. So I wanted to make sure whatever I did was going to bring all parts of me into the job. So Mechanic Shop, because I talk about car repairs, and Femme, because that's what I am, and I sort of put it together. And I primarily cover automotive ownership from every angle. So from buying a car, to selling the car, to insuring the car, to car maintenance, how to find a mechanic, and everything in between. If it involves regular people going about their daily lives with their regular vehicle, that's what I'm about.
Did you previously work as a mechanic?
I worked for about 7.5 years in the repair and collision industry. I primarily worked a customer-facing job where I worked with the people who came in to fix their cars. So I was like the intermediary, or how I like to put it is like the mechanic interpreter. So I would take the information the customer gave me to the mechanic, and then I would bring that information back to the customer.
Is this what initially sparked your passion for car ownership, stuff like that?
When I started in the automotive industry, I did not know anything about cars. I used to say I didn't know a bumper from an oil change, and it was 100% true. In fact, when I interviewed for the job, I interviewed for a job at Sears department store, and then they asked me what department I wanted to work in, and like a true Capricorn, I said, whichever one makes the most money. They offered automotive or appliances, and automotive sounded more interesting. So, of course, they followed up with, so do you have a driver's license? And my answer was no. Did not have a driver's license. Got my driver's license for the job at Sears Auto Center, the one that used to be in Glendale and Bayshore. And then I started, and it kind of just ended up being a natural fit. Like, it certainly wasn't something that I thought I was going to do long term. I thought this was a job where I was going to make enough money to put a roof over my head. You know, I had just aged out of the foster care system, and I needed work. It was 2013. There wasn't a huge amount of jobs available. My experience didn't serve me in any kind of, like, customer service or restaurant types of jobs. I couldn't even get interviews there. So just getting this job was huge. And once I got it, kind of like the rest was history, as they say.
What was it that you liked so much about this experience?
If you've ever heard like an English teacher or a math teacher say, you know, they live for the light bulb moment where they're teaching something to their students and it doesn't make any sense to them. And then all of a sudden, click, you know, the light bulb goes off and you can see it in their eyes like, oh, I understand now. Like, this makes sense. That was kind of how it was for me. So that's definitely one element to it. But it's also just bringing this basic information. Like, I'm not teaching you how to take apart your car or any kind of fancy information. I'm bringing the basics that everybody should know, that they should have been taught, that they were often not taught because they were queer and their parents were worried about making them unqueer instead of setting them up to survive in life, or because they were women and their parents didn't think that that information was appropriate to teach them or important to teach them. And I want to bring this basic knowledge to everyday consumers, because when you go into the shop and you come in and you already expect the worst and you already think that everybody is going to scam you, I'm trying to show people how to navigate through the challenges that are there, giving them the tools necessary to better understand their cars, to better understand mechanics, to know what kind of questions to ask. Things that make people's lives easier and better. In most of this country, we have to have a car in order to have access to better job opportunities, be able to take on more jobs. I remember when I was 18, I didn't have a driver's license and I didn't have a car, and I was trying to find a job. And my foster parents lived in Glendale in an area which wasn't accessible by bus. And it was very complicated and very difficult. And I strongly believe that getting that first car really helped me move out of poverty. If I wouldn't have had that opportunity to take on more jobs, to go further away, to be able to have access to these career opportunities, then I wouldn't have gotten to my next step. And for a lot of people, it's like that.
Could you tell me more about just like the type of impact that you want to have with the way you educate people about cars, especially as it relates to inclusivity?
Have you ever heard of blinker fluid?
No.
Okay. A common thing that most people who don't know anything about cars hear from mechanics and car people and YouTube videos is blinker fluid. Blinker fluid is nonsense. It doesn't exist. It's been invented by the gatekeeping car bros and car enthusiasts and industry people to make fun of people who want to know more about their car, who want to fix their car. So they'll be like, oh, don't forget to replace your blinker fluid or other kind of stuff. But blinker fluid doesn't exist. It's fake. It doesn't exist. Because people think it's funny, but it's not funny because it is it's like the word that's like the tip of the iceberg that's wrong with the industry, right? I approach my work, my book, my videos, all elements of what I do by trying to think of how it will impact the most amount of people and how I can be inclusive to the most amount of people, particularly to the people that have not been included in these conversations and in these education opportunities and in this industry historically since the beginning of time.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that example for me. I think it really clarifies how your work is countering the existing frustrations that people encounter when they're trying to learn about something.
One of the most impactful articles I feel like I've written over the last couple of years is an article about sexism in the automotive industry and how it's impacting the number of mechanics available to repair cars. Because think about it, if you go into a shop as a queer person or as a woman or as a person of color, because that's a whole other conversation to have. If you go into the shop as a marginalized person and you're treated like crap, the likelihood that you will then go enter that industry or you'll talk to your friends or siblings or children about entering that industry is pretty much none. And we have a massive shortage of mechanics in this country at this moment, huge shortage. There's not enough people to fix cars, and mechanics don't work to the same age that many other industries do because of the impacts on your body that this type of work has. So there's a shortage, and that shortage is only getting bigger. And that shortage could be simply fixed by including over 50% of the population that is now being excluded from those opportunities. So I wrote an article about that, talking about experiences of sexism that people have had while working in shops. If you're a woman and you walk into a shop and you're treated poorly or oversold products or you aren't explained services and stuff like that, now imagine how it is to work as a woman in those same places. So if shops become better for their employees, they will also become better for their customers and vice versa.
Thinking about the work that you're doing in educating, you are currently in the process of writing a book.
I am thankfully done. Done writing the book. The book is available for pre-order now. It comes out on April 9th.
Could you tell us a little bit about what someone could expect to find if they pick up the book?
Sure. So the book is like putting the last decade of my automotive experience into one concise, easy to read, easy to understand guide to car ownership. This is not intended to be the only part of your car ownership experience. Like, it's intended to be used in conjunction with a good mechanic and things like that. And it starts by telling you how to buy a car, and then moving into how to insure that car, and then how to find a mechanic for that car, and then how to maintain that vehicle, what maintenance you should do yourself, what maintenance you should do at the mechanic. Well, obviously, you could do whatever maintenance you want by yourself, but given the people who will be reading my book, most people will be more interested in that. So let's say, you know, your old car is kind of on its last legs, there's a lot of problems with it, and you are deciding whether you need to replace it. You go to the section where I talk about how to decide if it's time to move on. And then you make your decision at the end of that. And then you could go to the chapter where how to sell your car. And then you could go to the chapter on how to buy another vehicle. And it all kind of works hand in hand.
You said this a little bit earlier about how you really like helping people have those light bulb moments. I was really curious if you had a memorable light bulb moment where you were giving someone advice and everything became really clear to them.
Sometimes I make videos about stuff that people have heard exactly the opposite information and share, like, why this is necessary. For example, my brand partner iFixit sponsored a video on winter car myths, like all kinds of stuff related to winter, because, you know, especially in Wisconsin, but anywhere where it's cold, people have a lot of things that they've heard over the years that they need to do with their car, don't need to do with their car when it's cold, because cold weather and car breakdowns really scare people. So often these things are rooted in a bit of truth, but they have at some point lost their truth to them. The one that people really are like, oh my God, what is warming up your car? You don't need to warm up your car. It's not necessary. Warming up your car was something that was necessary when you had carbureted vehicles. So like the early 90s. For the most part, cars today do not need to be warmed up. You turn your car on, you put your seatbelt on. By that time, 30 seconds elapses and you are good to go. There's no reason for you to continue warming up your vehicle. In fact, sitting in your car and idling your vehicle or letting your car idle in the driveway while you're sitting in your house is bad for the environment. Here's the misconception with people. One group of people have been told they have to warm up their car for their engine and it's terrible to do it otherwise. And another group of people thinks warming up your car is for your comfort and not for the car. And of course, you can do whatever you need to do for your comfort. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about warming up the car for the sake of the car. Not necessary. So lots of light bulb moments around that.
Now I'm sort of reflecting on all that I've been told about cars and how much of it may or may not be accurate. Why do you think that there is so many myths out there that people don't think twice about checking if it's accurate or not?
Misogyny, racism, homophobia. They're so busy trying to gatekeep cars from more than half the population, that if a man says something, then obviously the man is right. And the worst part of all of this is that most of the time the man is wrong, because these things negatively impact men too. It doesn't just, people think, oh, sexism, it's just about the women, or racism, it's just about the people of color. No. These things impact every single person. When you block half the population from automotive knowledge, you are also blocking every single man that doesn't know anything about cars, because now cars are tied to your masculinity. If you ask a question about cars to your mechanic and it's a silly question, then you are looked at as less of a man, or you might feel like you're less of a man because you're going to ask this question. But that hurts you too. So you pick up some myths from somebody, you hear something on the internet, you don't ask clarifying questions, then you teach your kids that. And you teach your spouse that. People say my book's for teenagers. It is, but it's also not. It's for women in their 50s and 60s that have recently gotten divorced or their spouses have passed, who've never taken their car in for an oil change. It's for queer folks and women who never had the opportunity to learn these types of subjects, or they learned them from somebody who didn't know what they were talking about, perpetuating this, you know, these continued myths. And it's for men. It's for men who don't feel like they can ask the questions, that they don't feel like they have the information, because it's emasculating.
Kaya Milstein is an automotive educator and the author of Mechanic Shop Femme's Guide to Car Ownership, which is officially out now. She spoke with WUWM's Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly in January. You can learn more and find a link to Milstein's blog at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. We'll take one more break and then return with some trail recommendations in the Milwaukee County Park System. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The snow has melted, the temperatures are warming, and with the taste of sunshine we've had lately, it's time to spend more time outside. One way to get out into the fresh air is through enjoying the extensive trail system Milwaukee County has to offer. People can bike, walk, or run on more than 125 miles of paved trails, not to mention the hiking and river trails. To get some recommendations on where to explore, I spoke to Jessica Weinberg from the Milwaukee County Parks.
We have over 170 miles of trails actually in Milwaukee County that are under the jurisdiction of Milwaukee County Parks. I think most people might know about the Oak Leaf Trail, but still be surprised to find out it's 130 miles. Our hiking trails together are about 40 miles. Our mountain biking trails are around 10. So we're really excited to offer so many miles of different things. And we have water trails along the Milwaukee River as well.
So how interconnected are all of these trail systems as well?
Yeah, the trails are very interconnected. The vision of the Oak Leaf Trail originally was that it would be a way to connect many of the parks together so that people could ride from one neighborhood to another and to all the different parks along the way. And the Oak Leaf Trail really does serve that purpose in many areas. And then in those parks, you can find a hiking trail or a boat launch for the water trail or a mountain bike trail. So really everything is very connected. Some of our hiking trails, however, are, you know, just in a small neighborhood park and there's no official trail connection to that, but it's quiet neighborhood streets and people in that neighborhood could easily access it, or you can drive there if you like.
Well, I think that's one kind of nice thing or neat thing you discover as you live here longer, explore the parks and trails, is that there are a lot of hidden gems that are kind of off the beaten path. So what are a few trail routes or trailheads that you'd recommend that you think are kind of underutilized for the amount of traffic that the other trailheads can get?
Yeah, there's so many choices. So maybe one of the biggest is the Milwaukee River Greenway, which in total is about 8 miles of hiking trail, plus the river that you can kayak or canoe as well. And some people do know about it, some people don't. It's becoming less and less of a hidden gem. It is hiking only, and there's numerous trailheads at the major parks along the Milwaukee River between Hampton and North Avenue. So you can go to Caesars Park, you can go to Riverside Park, you can go to Estabrook Park, you can go to Lincoln Park, Kern, Gordon, and all find a nice access to the trail. Portions of that trail are operated by other entities such as Shoreward and Hubbard Park. So you have two beer gardens to stop at if you do the full 8 mile hiking loop to make it a party for everybody.
Absolutely. So how about a river trail specifically? I know you mentioned some are interconnected.
Yeah, officially, our only water trails are along the Lake Michigan shore and along the Milwaukee River. And I think maybe more and more people are seeing people boat south of North Avenue on the Milwaukee River and in the Inner Harbor, which is really nice. But you can, based on water levels, start farther north if you like. A good beginner place to start paddling is Lincoln Park, and there's a few islands in Lincoln Park, and the river does a very cool like double oxbow, so you can more have like a lake-like experience where the current's very low. You can kind of go in circles and go upstream or downstream relatively easily, but it is really important to check water levels. And I think Milwaukee River Keeper has kind of the best up-to-date information on water trails and levels, and they have a free map that we partnered with them on developing, which is really great for all the launch sites. So for hiking, we talked about the Milwaukee River Greenway, but I'd also like to add that the KK River has a really wonderful hidden hiking trail. The best place to access that is at 51st and the Kinnickinnick Parkway. And then you head west along the river. There's also a little footbridge, and you can go south across the river and then go either east or west. In total, it's a little under 2 miles of trails if you do all the little segments, but it's really pretty, and it's a kind of a naturalized, semi-naturalized portion of the Kinnickinnick River that isn't something we see too much of in Milwaukee, but is happening more and more.
And how about for people taking their bikes out? What route would you recommend?
Yeah, I don't know if any of our bike trails are as hidden, but they're all really lovely. I do think a really beautiful ride, if people haven't done it, is through Warnemont Park. So that's a portion of the South Shore line of the Oakleaf Trail. It's really beautiful. It's also worth stopping, locking up your bike, and walking on the hiking trails there. There's some really unique microclimates that are interesting. And then I would say that along the Root River is really beautiful too, and maybe a little off the beaten track. If you don't live on the south side, maybe you haven't biked along the Root River line of the Oakleaf Trail, but it's really beautiful, and a lot of nature experience is possible there.
Are there any trail routes you'd recommend for anyone taking kids along? So, you know, either by bike or walking, but something that's maybe a shorter loop, something that's easily found and accessible and near some parks, playgrounds, or buildings.
Yeah, I think the best thing to do is probably to download our Park Explorers app, and all the hiking trails are listed there, and you can see the length. And I think probably one of the best things Parks has is great trails for families with very young children. We have a number of parks that have trails that are 0.4 miles long. Turns out if you have a 2-year-old or maybe even a 4-year-old, a 0.2 mile hike might be perfect, and there's a playground there. So I highly recommend kind of checking those out. Copernicus Park is one example. That actually has a bit of a paved trail through the woods, so that's good for a stroller. Most of our, when I talk about hiking trails, they are generally earthen surface, so a more rugged stroller can handle it, but not a totally normal one. The Oakleaf Trail is great for strollers and people walking as well. I would be careful along the lakefront. You know, on very busy days, sometimes people are going fast, so it's a hard place for little kids to learn to bike or to be new on their bikes, but they're, you know, just great in strollers or walking.
So what's your favorite spot to go to?
Yeah, I think right now I kind of have two. McGovern Park is one of my current favorites. There's a really beautiful woodland and lagoon in the middle of the park. And in the spring, the wildflowers were just beautiful. And then I just found out there's a state champion chinkapin oak in this park. So I think that's a wonderful place to go and contemplate what Milwaukee looked like before there was more human encroachment and changes. I also love going to Bender Park and just overlooking the lake. There's really beautiful views, and I think it's the best picnic spot in Milwaukee. If you're willing to take the little hike to find a picnic table that's on the bluff, it's really beautiful. I joke that it's like the best proposal site that nobody knows about. But we'll see. Maybe someone will make that come true.
That's true. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining me today to share more about Milwaukee County Parks Trail System.
Thank you. And people can check the parks website or our Facebook page for details on Trail Thursdays and all the different parks that we'll be going to through the rest of the summer.
Jessica Weinberg is the Trails Coordinator for Milwaukee County Parks. We spoke in July of 2022, and you can find out more information at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, a new episode of Chirp Chat explores spring migration and the Mississippi Flyway. Plus, we'll speak with the director of the new documentary, Sherry and Lamb Chop, which will be kicking off the Milwaukee Film Festival this week. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.